The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
This is Sirius XM. I'm John Fugelsang. For the next 3 hours, we'll be coming at you with all the news you can handle, all the hot takes to win all your debates at the water cooler the next day. Maybe a little bit of trivia, something approaching comedy, and enough smart, moral, brilliant guests to elevate the entire proceedings far beyond what I have to offer. Tonight, Simon Moya-Smith and Julie Franchella will be with us for another installment of our Indigenous Voices segment. We are very glad that they're going to be with us, and you guys can talk tonight. You're welcome to call and join us. Also, former Ambassador Ira Shapiro is here to talk about the new edition of his book, The Betrayal, How Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans Abandoned America. It's a dynamite book about how the Senate responded to the challenges posed by the Trump administration under Trump, and of course, what happened to Biden as well. And it's all about how McConnell thought he could use Trump to turn the court to the right and kill the Affordable Care Act and cut taxes for the rich, and he succeeded in two-thirds of those goals. I'm really thrilled to have Ambassador Shapiro on to talk about this book. And as always, our most important guest is you guys. We are at 866-997-4748. 866-997-GRIT. That's our number around these parts. New York Appeals Court has overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction after finding that the judge for the trial handed down some improper rulings. This was like the main tentpole of the Me Too movement, and it really changed how business is done in this country. There was a wave of allegations against the guy. He was sentenced to 23 years in jail. Now he's going to get a new trial. He's still serving a 16-year sentence for raping other people in California. But let's see what happens. Go, Harvey Weinstein. The next amazing thing is he suddenly won't need that wheelchair anymore. Remember that? It was a crazy day in the news today. And in New York, National Enquirer publisher David Pecker spent a third day on the witness stand as the prosecution tried to follow the money in Trump's ill-nicknamed hush money trial. College protests in support of Palestinians have spread far beyond the Ivy League. We've been talking about it. There was violence today between police and protesters at Emory in Atlanta. USC has canceled their main graduation ceremony altogether. I guess they're afraid of someone saying something sympathetic towards Palestine, and that might ruin the commencement? In a statement elsewhere, TikTok parent company ByteDance said they would rather cease operations in the U.S. than see themselves sold off to the highest bidder. And a federal judge has dismissed Donald Trump's appeal of the E. Jean Carroll defamation verdict, upholding the $83 million judgment he still owes her. 20% of all milk samples tested nationwide show traces of H5N1 bird flu, and former Trump Surgeon General Jerome Adams tells Business Insider it has spread. The delayed government response is reminding him eerily of early 2020. All right, let's get to the big story of the day. It's the Supreme Court, and I'm dying to know what you guys thought. I never really thought I would see it get this far. You know, after seeing a racist reality TV show landlord clown become president, you think, well, we've jumped the shark. America has gone full trash. We can't get more bizarre than this. And then you have a day where an attorney for a former president is arguing in front of the Supreme Court that a president should be immune from prosecution if they have their political opponents murdered. That was what today was. I mean, today was a stupid, stupid argument taken to great lengths for no reason other than to help the defendant hit the snooze button on justice. The argument today in Trump versus United States was today was a bad day for Jack Smith. Today was a bad day for the Department of Justice. And today was a bad day for any American at any point in history who believes the president of the United States is not a king. It's a bad day for anyone who thinks the president should be subject to prosecution if they commit a crime. The Supreme Court, Axios had a cute headline. They said the Supreme Court appears poised to hand former President Trump a win in his strategy of delaying his legal troubles. But that's it. He's already had a win. The hearing today was the win. This is pertaining to Donald Trump's January 6th case, which I have said for a while is the most important court case of our lifetimes. It is the federal indictment of Donald Trump for attempting to overturn the results of a presidential election. And it's centered around how he incited a violent insurrection against his own government, the federal case for election interference. And it was supposed to begin in March. The fact that we are having this hearing, that you can't try him for crimes because presidents can't commit crimes, and we're having this about 55 days or so after the trial was supposed to begin, it's how Trump has already won. It's a stupid argument by a stupid man that he's trying to run out the clock so he can't be convicted before the election. But the concept of immunity itself, I mean, presidential immunity goes against one of our foundational principles that no one is above the law. Not even powerful people are above the law. But it turns out they are. And it turns out this is a lie we teach children to make them feel our country is not an aristocracy. And before the trial this morning, here's Comb over Caligula. He took the Big Macs out of his mouth and the spoon out of his nose long enough to spit out a few words about presidential immunity and the Supreme Court.
I think that the Supreme Court has a very important argument before it today. I would have loved to have been there, but this judge would not allow that to happen. I should be there, but he wouldn't allow it to happen. I think he puts himself above the Supreme Court, which is unfortunate, isn't it? But the argument on immunity is very important. The president has to have immunity. This has nothing to do with me. This has to do with a president in the future for 100 years from now. If you don't have immunity, you're not going to do anything. You're going to become a ceremonial president. You're just going to be doing nothing. You're not going to take any of the...
It's like listening to Satan defecate in your bathroom, isn't it? I'm sorry. Did you notice he even found a way to wag his tiny, rice-like, diseased, covered with scabs junk at the judge to violate the gag order one more time? Now, the Supreme Court seemed a little hesitant to totally resolve this issue of presidential immunity because they don't need to. Their job is to get Trump reelected and to give him the delay he has sought. So they had to show up today and do something for one day and then do nothing until June, which will guarantee the public won't have the benefit of having a jury show us before an election if Donald Trump tried to steal the last one. I mean, right now, the likelihood of just one case wrapping before the election is the best scenario Donald Trump could have wished for. It looks like Donald Trump's only going to see one of his four criminal cases conclude before the election. This is why we call it rigged. And in a sane country, this case today would have never made it to our Supreme Court. The fact that this hearing happened, that the question of whether U.S. presidents are actually really monarchs who get to legally murder people if they feel like it, that this even got to the Supreme Court, shows Trump already won. The oligarchs, the aristocrats who want more Trump tax cuts, who want more Trump deregulation, they want more Trump pollution. That's jobs, jobs, jobs. They want more Trump class war against those poor, swarthy and working Americans. They are going to make sure the American people don't get to see a trial. They're going to make sure the American people don't get to hear evidence before Election Day. And by the way, Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny, God bless, if there's ever a couple that deserved each other, we know she was deeply involved in those treasonous efforts. And yet, Clarence Thomas, who should be listed on the NASDAQ because it's so easy to buy him, has decided he doesn't have to recuse himself. At least two of the current justices should not be on the Supreme Court at all. Brett Kavanaugh lied about many subjects in his hearings. Neil Gorsuch has a stolen seat. They're illegitimate. Clarence Thomas should have recused himself. I mean, usually arguments that are heard in late April bring decisions late June, early July. The court could act fast if they wanted to. We know they can act fast when they want to, but they do things to benefit the Republican Party. They do things to benefit Donald Trump. We'll get to that in a minute. Now, the justices could still limit the charges he faces and delay his trial on election interference charges. The court could decide the lower courts need to investigate more. The lower courts need to investigate if immunity applies to what Trump did. They didn't talk about Trump, though. They didn't talk about the insurrection. There was no talk of January 6th. There was no talk of the actual crimes that brought them all here for this day. There was no talk about the fact that the man who committed these crimes and is saying that he's allowed to commit crimes is trying to be president again. The point of the hearing was an academic jerk-off about presidential immunity. And all it really was a bunch of pot and paid for whores and shills slowing down justice to help a criminal. Because they like him. They like this criminal. Normally, to see something slowed down like this, you've got to look over, I don't know, maybe the stolen classified documents case in Georgia, where Donald Trump also hired his lawyer. Do you see a pattern, my friends? Never before have we witnessed this, where a defendant has hired the judge. A defendant has given a job to the judge who is judging him, and that judge is doing anything they can do to let that defendant walk, because that defendant gave them the gig. And we're watching it play out. And future generations will wonder, how could we, how did we allow this? The fact that this hearing even happened today with three judges who he hired, another judge whose wife is in on it, texting Donald Trump's chief of staff the day of the terrorist attack that killed people at our Capitol. The fact that this hearing even happened is proof of corruption. It's proof of obstruction. It's proof of collusion. It's proof that the American aristocratic class has always controlled the power and continues to rig justice itself in its own favor. Folks, we were founded by wealthy, white, land-owning men who thought only they should vote because that's what freedom was to them. And that tradition continues. These are aristocrats. They believe in aristocracy. And all of them, from John Roberts on, they live in a world where they don't have to answer to you. They don't have to face you. They don't even have to share the same breathing space as you. Clarence Thomas has got better sugar daddies to fly him on vacations. So here at the Supreme Court today, Michael Dreeben answered Justice Samuel Alito's supposition that, hey, presidents have a lot of tough responsibilities and sometimes they make mistakes. Am I right? Give a listen.
I mean, presidents have to make a lot of tough decisions about enforcing the law, and they have to make decisions about questions that are unsettled, and they have to make decisions based on the information that's available. Do you really, did I understand you to say, well, you know, if he makes a mistake, he makes a mistake. He's subject to the criminal laws just like anybody else. You don't think he's in a special, a peculiarly precarious position?
He's in a special position for a number of reasons. One is that he has access to legal advice about everything that he does. He's under a constitutional obligation to, he's supposed to be faithful to the laws of the United States and the Constitution of the United States. And making a mistake is not what lands you in a criminal prosecution. Huh.
Great answer. But did you hear Alito bending backwards? I mean, good God, this poor guy, his job's so hard. What if he makes a mistake and spreads a lie and a conspiracy with false electors to steal the government and launches a terrorist attack on our Capitol? I mean, oops, right? Come on, cut the guy some slack. Biden has gaffes. At one point, Justice Sotomayor asked Trump lawyer John Sauer if the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military to assassinate him, is that within his official acts to which he has immunity? And Trump's lawyer said that could well be an official act, to have the military assassinate your rival. I mean, that the president's attorney told the Supreme Court that a president should have immunity if he orders one of his political rivals to be murdered for a military coup. I really hope Americans start to pay attention to this, because this was like some Star Wars Episode 3. This is how democracy dies in the Galactic Senate. Crazy stuff. I'm waiting to see fucking Palpatine show up behind the scenes. I mean, according to Trump's lawyer, if Trump returns to power, he could murder people. He could sell military secrets to Russia or China. He'd be completely immune from prosecution. He's the only president in history who's lost an election. The only president who refused to concede he had lost an election. The only president in history who would not participate in the peaceful transfer of power. Only this one. Now, I want you to listen to Brett Kavanaugh, who Donald Trump also hired, who has no business being on the Supreme Court. And I just want you to understand the universe these aristocrats live in, where they think that Ford's pardon of Nixon is considered to be a really good thing. Give a listen to this, and please don't, if you're driving, don't scream or yank your hair out. Pull over first. Here's Brett.
That is intentionally and knowingly false. That would pollute the legislative
process. How about, I think it came up before, President Ford's pardon. Mm-hmm. Very controversial in the moment.
Yes.
Hugely unpopular, probably why he lost in 76.
Yes.
Now looked upon as one of the better decisions in presidential history, I think, by most people. If he's thinking about, well, if I grant this pardon to Richard Nixon, could I be investigated myself for obstruction of justice on the theory that I'm interfering with the investigation of Richard Nixon?
Right-wing criminals think it was a good decision. Most historians don't. Brett Kavanaugh is not an historian, but Brett Kavanaugh lives in an aristocratic bubble. And by the way, since you brought it up, if presidential immunity exists, why did Gerald Ford have to grant a full pardon to Richard Nixon for crimes he may have committed against the government while he was president? Right? By your own logic, you alcoholic douche. If presidential immunity is a thing, then Ford never needed to give Nixon a pardon. John Yoo, remember him, the torture aficionado under the Bush administration, DOJ, said Trump had much more success than many court watchers expected. Only the three liberal justices seemed to reject the idea of immunity outright. I mean, and can I just take a moment to say, Democrats, you guys should have been screaming for the past year to make Clarence Thomas resign or recuse himself from all Trump cases. And a handful of them have. God bless you, Sheldon Whitehouse, a couple others. But Democrats, Senate, House, White House, why the hell haven't you guys been screaming about Clarence Thomas with this? We don't punish traitors in this country. Not if they're powerful. We didn't punish the Confederate traitors. We didn't punish Nixon. We let Iran-Contra slide. Nobody went to jail for the lies that led to the Iraq War, which killed hundreds of thousands of souls. And Donald Trump is never going to be held accountable by a Supreme Court he hired. They're trying to prevent the possibility of Donald Trump being tried before the election. But they don't want to limit Trump's ability to try to indict Joe Biden next year. Alito, more than all the other justices, really seemed pinned to the institutionalist stance that punishing a president would mean the fall of democracy.
I'm sure you would agree with me that a stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully if that candidate is the incumbent.
Of course.
All right. Now, if an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy? And we can look around the world and find countries where we have seen this process, where the loser gets thrown in jail.
I have to say, Alito at least reminds us Bush really may have been worse than Trump. Friend of the show, John Dean, legendary figure in Watergate, said today's SCOTUS argument on Trump's criminal immunity revealed an activist conservative majority that wants to provide presidential immunity. But they must get around Nixon v. Fitzgerald, 1982, which clearly states there is no criminal immunity for presidents. And certainly not for this one. Donald Trump's not a man. He's a corrupt, corrosive, petulant, pampered piggy. He's a millionaire at birth who's never had to follow rules. From tax law to insurance fraud to bank fraud, education fraud, his marriage vows, charity fraud, rape, and defamation. He is Putin's putrid prison punk, and he's always walked between the raindrops. He is every vacuous, selfish, insincere, spoiled brat, Wonka factory tour children whipped into a grotesque fondue that smells of adult diapers and too much cologne. And today, this syphilitic Augustus Gloop demanded that the president gets to be above the law. If they help him delay this trial, voters will be making their choice in the next election without hearing any of the new evidence Jack Smith has gathered on Donald Trump's conduct during the terrorist attack on our Capitol. The most likely outcome will be this court will kick it back to lower courts and delay the whole thing. And if Trump becomes president, he will order the DOJ to dismiss all the charges against him. Can the media please point out we never had debates about presidential immunity until we had a criminal as president? The only president in 235 years... who needs immunity because he's a career criminal? And the fact that the Supreme Court justice's wife was one of the organizers of this armed insurrection should be mentioned constantly? I'd like one of these judges to ask, how are you supposed to impeach the president for a coup if he's rounded up the House and Senate? If the court decides a former president can steal the nation's most sensitive documents with national security and show them anywhere he likes, steal the office, murder people, nothing anyone can do about it, then they're showing us exactly why we need to expand the court. Donald Trump personally appointed one-third of this court that's now deciding whether to grant him the ability to murder people and not be charged for it. And a lot of folks are going about their business like this is normal. There's a very real chance, brothers and sisters, that five or six justices will rule that a president can use his powers to commit really serious crimes. The Republican Party has gone from I am not a crook to a crook is not a crook. We want to know what you guys think. We're at 866-997-4748, 866-997-GRIT, and we'll be back in just a moment with Ambassador Ira Shapiro to talk about McConnell. This is Progress.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back. We are at 866-997-4748. I am so thrilled and delighted and honored to welcome this next guest back to our show. Let me quote him. Make no mistake, the Senate's performance during the Trump presidency is the story of the most catastrophic failure of government in American history. Ambassador Ira Shapiro served as chief U.S. trade negotiator with Japan and Canada and as general counsel in the Office of U.S. Trade Representatives during the Clinton administration. He's a former Senate staffer and author of the critically acclaimed The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, as well as Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? He now has completed his Senate trilogy with an incredible narrative about the state of the body itself during the Trump White House. It is The Betrayal. How Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans abandoned America. And he focuses quite presciently on how the Senate responded to the unique challenges posed by a reality game show host landlord administration. And of course, how things look under President Biden as well. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ambassador Ira Shapiro back to SiriusXM.
John, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me back.
Thank you so much. And I'm so thrilled you have updated this book because obviously it's been an interesting couple of years for Mitch McConnell. And a lot of us really thought that he was going to put his foot down against Trump in the end. I mean, he wanted Trump to turn the court to the right. He wanted Trump to kill the Affordable Care Act. He wanted Trump to cut taxes for the rich. He got most of those things. But I think after January 6th, a lot of us really thought McConnell meant it. He's the Dems' problem now. Let them deal with the son of a bitch, as he's quoted as saying. Of course, that hasn't been the case, and he just endorsed Trump for re-election. Why did you think it was necessary to update your excellent work?
Well, the book was recent history. It took the Trump years and the first Biden year, and I decided to bring it up to date. The publisher gave me the chance to cover the last 2 years, so the recent history becomes current history. But the truth is that, as you know, John, the premise of the book is that Donald Trump was a clear and present threat to our democracy from the beginning. But we're supposed to have institutions that are strong enough to balance and check that kind of threat.
Yes.
The Senate has the principal responsibility for doing so. And this Senate repeatedly, the Republican Senate under McConnell, repeatedly and knowingly failed to stop Trump. Most dramatically, of course, after the January 6th attack.
That's right.
They had failed a series of times. And after January 6th, I think we thought that McConnell, who gave great speeches about condemning Trump, would actually perhaps do something. And yet when the time came, the Senate Republicans exonerated Trump again and set in motion the last 3 years that we've seen. Trump should have been disqualified as a presidential candidate using the constitutional system. And it didn't happen. And what we're seeing is the struggle of the legal system to make up for the Senate's failure.
And of course, McConnell
and
voted
not
for
doing
Trump's
well.
Acquittal. Well, indeed. And Trump voted. I mean, McConnell voted for Trump's acquittal, and Trump thanked him by calling him a dour, sullen, unsmiling political hack. I mean, I'm still shocked at the abuse Mitch McConnell takes from this man and still rewards him with loyalty.
It is remarkable, actually. They detest each other, but McConnell has a reason to detest Trump. Trump's reason for detesting McConnell is that he's just an ingrate, basically. McConnell did a lot to make him president, did a lot for him as president, then saved him from impeachment, and yet Trump hates him. So why is McConnell doing this? And the answer, I think, unfortunately, is that ultimately his partisanship overwhelms his patriotism.
Indeed.
It would be now, there are rare exceptions, and we've actually witnessed one in the last period of months and more recently last week. I think McConnell played a very useful and seriously consistent role in saving military aid for Ukraine.
I
support that, and I think he was very consistent and for once acting on principle. But that's the exception. It's his best, finest hour, but we had to wait 40 years for it.
I completely agree. And we should also point out that during the second impeachment of Trump, when McConnell is washing his hands of him and so disgusted, McConnell would not allow any witnesses. He delayed the entire trial until Trump had left office and then declared it was unconstitutional to impeach a president who had left office. 7 Republicans voted to convict Trump. They needed 17. If Mitch McConnell had gotten behind this and told his senators that he was voting to convict, do you think we would have seen a different outcome?
Oh, no question. If McConnell had acted on the feelings that he had toward Trump and his belief that Trump had committed a high crime against the constitutional order. If he had acted on that, there would be 17 Republican votes. There might have been 25 Republican votes. There's no question. My theory, looking at it, John, is that McConnell felt Trump was still too strong in the Republican Party. And I think he thought Trump would wither away, basically, when she was out of office. Well, he underestimated Trump's depravity. He overestimated his own ability to control Trump while he was in the White House. And we're paying for that mistake still.
I've never seen a politician more interested in his immediate power and less interested in how he'll be judged by history. I mean, does it ever give you pause how seemingly indifferent McConnell is to how historians will no doubt regard his behaviors?
You're asking a good question, because very good question. I've thought about it a lot.
Yeah.
Just in February, McConnell, waxing philosophical, said, "History will settle every account." Well, my book is an attempt to help settle his account. But interestingly, I think he does care about his legacy, and yet not enough to make it shape his behavior. It's quite remarkable to me that Mitch McConnell, 40 years in the Senate, worked with seven presidents, knows with absolute certainty that the election of Donald Trump would be a disaster for the country and for our allies, starting with Ukraine and others in Europe. He knows that with an absolute certainty, and yet he still endorsed him. Republicans have faced continual tests of character, courage, and patriotism, and not very many of them have passed those tests.
Is it, Ambassador, because McConnell knows it would not be a disaster for the GOP donor base? Is that what drives it? I don't understand. At some point, you want to have your obituary read a certain way. And it just sort of, and you're right, these men despise each other. Is it just the fact that the big money donors on whom his legacy depends don't mind Trump?
Well, I certainly think his political career, his rise, and his long stay in power has reflected his understanding of the donor base, his devotion to them, the raising of money from them, and the rewards that they have received through legislation and regulation, or lack of regulation and lack of legislation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all true. At some point, I think he gets beyond that, and it's simply the red team versus the blue team.
Yeah, I think you're
basically
right.
That's all. I mean, that's all there is. There's no other justification for it. So it's been, look, I think I give him credit for Ukraine, as I said.
Me too.
I give him credit for everything he's done for the country. It just took very few pages in my book.
Mm-hmm.
I think he will be remembered for two things. One that he didn't do, stop Trump, when he had the responsibility and the opportunity.
Yes.
And the second that he did do, create the extreme Supreme Court supermajority that they have through a corrupted confirmation process. Those two things are likely to be his legacy. And I'm not sure he can live with it, but it's what Rudy Giuliani once said, John. You may remember someone asked him, "Look what you're doing to your legacy." He said, "What do I care? I'll be dead."
Exactly. That's it. I mean, they'll take the earthly accolades right now and the earthly bribes and the earthly praise and not worry about how their grandchildren have to deal with the family name. I want to point out, also, Ambassador, you don't write this guy off as a common political hack. You do have respect, begrudging respect for him, despite his evil ways. What do you admire about him?
Oh, I have grudging respect for his exceptional political ability. He is clearly, you know, he was an old basketball fan, and sometimes I think he plays above the rim. He's a superb strategist and tactician. He's a master of the fundraising system, much of which he created along with the Citizens United Supreme Court. He's a hardball negotiator. He's extremely effective in pursuing his own objectives. But those have been partisan objectives rather than anything much for the country. And as a result, if you look back, he diminished the Obama presidency.
He
turned the Senate into a bitter, hyper-partisan battleground. And he's given us this Supreme Court. That's a lot of damage to do to all three branches of government.
Mm. Ambassador, you worked in the Senate for over a decade, and you worked with the Senate with the Clinton administration, and you've written three books about the Senate in a decade. I'm very curious. What was it that first fascinated you about this body?
Well, I've probably given the Senate much more thought than any reasonable person should. But actually, John, I'm old enough that I came of age during the last constitutional crisis. Vietnam War, which morphed almost seamlessly into Watergate.
Yeah.
At that time, when I was looking at the country and the institutions and trying to figure out what I was going to do with my career, the Senate was a beacon of hope. The Senate was the place that passed civil rights legislation, that basically took, debated, and ultimately stopped the Vietnam War, finally.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the place that held Nixon accountable for Watergate, along with other branch of the government, the House as well. And so for me, I had the chance to get to the Senate as an intern at a time when it was formative for my career. So I loved working there when I came back. And my books were decades later. I circled back to find out what had gone wrong, basically. And the first book was How the Senate Was When It Was Great.
Right.
And then it was the declining Senate. And then it was the Senate that catastrophically failed.
When did it peak, Ambassador? When do you think it peaked?
I think the Senate peaked. The Senate was very strong in the 1960s and through the 1970s.
Yeah.
I once said it was strong for 18 years, 63 to 80. But it kind of worked on memory even after it became less liberal in the 1980s. It still worked like the Senate. By about the end of the 80s, and particularly as you got into the 90s, the Gingrich effect in the House started spilling over into the Senate. And it's been a downhill slog since then.
I would certainly agree. I always find it amusing when pundits think that this whole culture, this corrosive culture, began with Donald Trump. He's more to me like the hood ornament on the car that's been crashing into our democracy for a couple of decades now. And he's assumed many forms. Trump is just the most noxious version of him. But let me ask you about McConnell, because when he announced that he would be stepping down as leader a few months back, there were all these glowing tributes to him talking about how engaged he was with the civil rights movement, how he was there in 1963. And this, of course, is the history that he pushes and leaves out his appearance in front of Confederate flags, leaves out his work against the Voting Rights Act, leaves out his work against any kind of civil rights in a while. But his early years in the Senate didn't really indicate he'd become this amoral and ruthless. His role model was John Sherman Cooper, who I understand was a very ethical and pretty moderate Republican. Would Senator Cooper be embarrassed or appalled by the actions of his protege?
Well, John, first of all, when somebody announces that they're going to step down, there's a certain amount of, certain amount of praise they get. It's part of the process. I think that, we shouldn't take that all that seriously.
Right.
Second, his years as a civil rights champion were like 20 years before he ever got to the Senate. By the
exactly.
time of the 80s, he was a more conventional Republican.
That's
not
right.
by any means in my mind a racist, but certainly no civil rights champion.
Indeed.
John Sherman Cooper was more than just a moderate or good Republican. He was a superb senator and a superb, like a statesman turned senator. So he was a great person to emulate, but I think he would be rolling over in his grave about McConnell's career, with the exception of McConnell's work on Ukraine. I guess after 40 years, he's done something for the country finally.
I guess. I mean, I'm grateful for it, but it's hard to not connect the dots on everything we're experiencing right now, sir. I'll leave you with this. We witnessed in the Supreme Court today lawyers for this reality show president arguing that a president is allowed to commit crimes, that we have a king who can rule with impunity and is above the law. And it's important to stress this. This ridiculous obscenity that was only there to delay his trial so the American people can't hear evidence before they vote. This whole presidential immunity sham. Mitch McConnell is the reason this happened, isn't it? We can thank him for what we witnessed today.
Yes. I mean, my only disagreement recently with Joe Biden when he said one person is responsible for the attack on reproductive rights, Donald Trump. Actually, it's two people. There would not be that Supreme Court if Mitch McConnell hadn't blocked Merrick Garland in 2016. And then hadn't rammed through three nominations, the third of which, Amy Coney Barrett, was 8 days before the election.
Boom.
So he's responsible for this Supreme Court. And he claims, I think he's proud of it in some respects. He says he is. But I think it's a disaster for the country. And it'll only be something to be proud of if it prompts us to put term limits on these justices. Amen. And ask the first three of them, Roberts, Alito, and Thomas, to leave after their 18 years.
Ambassador Ira Shapiro's book is The Betrayal, How Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans Abandoned America. It is a great book about the last couple of decades in our Senate, why our Senate matters and how it got this way. I also want to say it makes a terrific gift for the fan of politics and government in your life. Ambassador, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Our platform is always open to you. Thank you so much for joining us on SiriusXM.
Don, thank you for having me. It's going to be a very important 6.5 more months, so I hope we'll talk again.
I hope you'll come back and visit us again. It would be a pleasure. Thank you so much. A quick break. We'll be right back with your calls at 866-997-4748. This is Progress.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
This is SiriusXM Progress. I'm John Fugelsang. We're going to be joined very shortly by Simon Moya-Smith and Julie Francella. Let's go to the phones right now and say hello, shall we? Everyone wants to talk to Simon and Julie. Bill in New Jersey, welcome. You're on Progress.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm doing okay. I think there was a judge ruling, though, on Trump that he's required to have three layers of 72-hour full body deodorant when he goes into court.
Well, that was an FDA thing, actually. I think that was FEMA petitioned that as well.
Right.
It's for the public good. Yeah.
Right. But this whole thing comes from Garland. The dumbest thing that Biden did was to make a judge in charge of law enforcement. Judges are supposed to be deliberative and slow, and he was given this as a consolation prize, which is not a very good reason to make someone AG.
Yeah, that's a fair, it's a fair argument, yeah. But as our last guest pointed out, we can blame Mitch McConnell for this, too, because Mitch McConnell is the reason Merrick Garland is not serving as a boring center-left judge on the court right now.
Right. And, I mean, the biggest thing with McConnell, to me, was the fact that his wife was working for the executive branch under two administrations while he was running the Senate.
Exactly.
And,
and by the way, and the president, President Trump can't stop being racist about his wife and calling her various racist taunts, even though she served in his cabinet. And Mitch McConnell responds to racist attacks on the woman he married by endorsing Donald Trump for president.
Right. And don't forget about Gorsuch's mother.
Yeah. Tell the folks about Gorsuch's mother.
She was appointed head of the EPA, and she was the
under
first,
Reagan.
Under Reagan, yeah. She was the first cabinet member to be sanctioned by the Congress.
But when she took over the EPA, it was the end of the 70s, and she just stopped prosecuting polluters, especially water polluters.
Right.
I mean, like, his mother was someone who made it okay through government to let businesses pollute more. That's who raised him.
But she had a couple of scandals, one of which is on a Superfund. She denied money to an area in California to stop a Democrat from winning there or something. And she was in with the oil industry and one other guy. And but she was had to step down in disgrace. And this is his mother, you know.
Yeah.
And she was loosening up all the laws and everything. It sucked.
And what's more Trumpian than hiring someone in charge of an agency to destroy it? That's what Republicans do. I mean, Trump made a homeschooler in charge of education. You know, this is like he put a brain surgeon in charge of housing. I mean, they deliberately hire unqualified people or people, you know, like Amy Coney Barrett, who was hired not to replace Ruth Ginsburg, but to undo Ruth Ginsburg. And the same with Clarence Thomas. He was hired not to replace the first black justice on the court, Thurgood Marshall, but to undo the work of Thurgood Marshall. That's what they do. And his mom ran the EPA and she slashed the budget and allowed more pollution.
Right.
And now her son continues this assault.
Right. And just put these things together. The Fifth Amendment, immunity and pardon. And they all mean guilty.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
There's no reason they should be arguing over pardons if he didn't do anything.
They found a way around guilt, didn't they? They have found a way around guilt.
Yeah.
Who knew that hiring your own judges can be very good when you become a defendant?
Yeah, I guess so. And the last thing that bothers me the hell is
really quick.
Trump walking around with these papers with clippings on them and of him talking about when they gave away the boxes of the documents. He said he had clippings in there and his clothing was in there, too, which is his personal possessions. And who the hell hangs on to newspaper clippings? You know, they have digital storage and everything.
Donald Trump has always done that. That's something about the guy. He keeps a lot of things. He's a hoarder and he has a lot of crap. He always has. Look at any video of his office in Trump Tower from back in the previous decade. I would believe that he thought he could keep stuff and that he liked to keep stuff because he's a pack rat. I could believe that. It's just after the National Archives asked for our stuff back, that's when the lies began. That's when he only returned some of the documents, and he's not being prosecuted for the ones he returned. It's all of the other Michigas that, you know, makes his cover story the clumsy lie it is. Mm-hmm. I got to run, man, but I thank you.
Dig it.
You raised the bar, Bill. Right on. Simon Moya Smith is with us. He is an Oglala Lakota and Chicano journalist. He is the contributing writer at NBC News and The Nation, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Your Spirit Animal is a Jackass. He's adjunct professor of indigenous studies at the University of Colorado, Denver. Simon, it is so good to have you back.
Well, I love being here, man.
Well, thank you. Thanks for classing up our show, along with Julie Franchella, who is an activist, a writer, a veteran mental health professional with over 28 years of experience working with complex trauma in the clinical field. She served as executive director of a domestic violence center and spent 13 years as a clinical caseworker at a residential center for Indigenous youth and families. Julie is working with the First Nations University of Canada and is a professor at Durham College, where she teaches about the profound impacts of colonization on First Nations people. And half of the East Street Band members are buying your paintings, Julie. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the air, but you are really, your work is really popular with some of my favorite rock stars that play with Bruce Springsteen. They're really into your work. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm very happy to be here as always.
Well, thank you. So let me jump into it right away. This new study, Julie, you were telling me about this, that shows that anti-Indigenous bias, which is something that most white people never think about, never witness, never have to think about, but that it's gotten so bad that there's reports of First Nations patients at disproportionate levels leaving emergency rooms before they can even be seen?
Yeah, absolutely. So a new study that was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal shows a concerning trend about the effect of systemic racism, you know, on First Nations health. And according to this study, First Nations patients leave emergency rooms or departments without being seen disproportionately more so than non-First Nations patients. So I think it shows nearly 7% of First Nations patients' visits to an emergency department end in them not receiving care. And that is significant. One of the, you know, the study, it's really important to talk about, because I think it really does reveal deep-seated anti-Indigenous biases in the healthcare system. And in the context of these biases in emergency departments, there are several specific injustices that stand out. You know, this article, actually, this study was referencing just direct racism. So what had happened in one case, I guess there was a doctor who went on a racist rant against Native people, and Indigenous people overheard the rant and basically, you know, got up and left because they didn't feel safe receiving care from a doctor that would have such, you know, racist views. And there are several other, incidences like that. But also, and another thing I wanted to point out, there's evidence to suggest that Indigenous patients' reports of pain are often taken less seriously. And that leads, obviously, to inadequate pain management and suffering. And sometimes it's due to stereotypes that wrongly suggest Indigenous people have either higher pain thresholds or are seeking drugs. And I just want to jump in really quickly. I want Simon to talk about this too, but I have a personal incident where this actually happened to me. A couple of years after I gave birth to my second daughter, my youngest daughter, I was living on reserve, and I had to drive 100 miles to the nearest hospital, and I was hospitalized for a kidney stone. And as a young, you know, single mother, I needed to leave the hospital to be able to care for my daughters. And so when I was leaving, the doctor refused to give me pain medication and actually said out loud that they weren't going to give me pain medication because they were afraid that I was going to go to the reservation and sell the drugs.
That's it.
And that happened to me. That was in 2008. So it's not that long ago.
And you're literally a trauma counselor, and they were afraid you would go sell the painkillers at the res.
Yeah. They just saw it checked off on my file that I was Native and I was living on the res, and, you know, that's all they needed. And it was mortifying. Simon, and what do you say? You know, because I needed to get out of there. And did I go back to that hospital again? Never. Never.
I mean, Simon, I'm reading this study with the Canadian Medical Association Journal. And I got to say, I keep thinking half of these stories have got to be patients who go to an emergency room and they're turned off by the particular kinds of questions they're asked.
Yeah. Well, it's also in the clinics. So Indian Health Services, they're dicks. I hated going as a kid.
Tell me.
I really hated going as a kid. They were mean.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe racism, maybe because they wanted to be a doctor in another state and now they're working at a clinic looking after natives. Who the fuck knows? But I hated going as a kid. They were mean. And this happens a lot, not just in emergency rooms, like I said, with Indian Health Services, but it is that stereotype. As soon as a native walks in, they're like, oh, the native's a drunk, or the native is on some sort of drugs. And it's so common, but I'm going to take a step back. I think we throw out terms that I think people need to understand. First Nation is the term in Canada. Here, it's referred to as Native American, even though, again, we're not American in that sense. We're pre-American. Mm-hmm. And then also reservations and reserves. Up north in Canada, those are going to be reserves. Here, they're called reservations. But in Mexico, there's neither. And up in Alaska, there's no reservations. There's no reserves. They're just villages. So even up there, and I remember Ray was on the show and she had a wonderful experience with Indian Health Services in Alaska. But here in the United States, it sucks. And we still get stereotyped regardless if it's in the emergency room or a clinic.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And there's also, you know, a bias and a lack of cultural competence. And that leads to misdiagnosing and underdiagnosing of medical conditions for Indigenous patients. And again, you know, it's a lot of it is due to misconceptions about the prevalence of certain conditions within Indigenous populations or just dismissal of symptoms. And oftentimes, you know, as Simon was saying, you know, oh, it's just another Indian coming in. And, you know, oftentimes mm-hmm. they're not listened to. They're not asked questions. They're just dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. I mean, I get it. And it's systemic racism in a healthcare system. And it's the sort of thing that a lot of comfortable people never have to think about.
Yeah.
Well, and then also remember, this is typically around reservations. You're not going to, like, right. In New York City, they're not going to go, oh, here's a drunk Indian. I'm sure they've never met one. So they never met an Indigenous person. But if you go somewhere like here in New Mexico or up in, you know, South Dakota, North Dakota, that's where it gets really prevalent.
Right on. Yeah. We are at 866-997-4748. We have a lot of listeners who want to say hi to you guys tonight. I hope you can handle that in between our various stories. Brian in Oregon, welcome. You're on Sirius XM with Simon and Julie. You're up, man.
Hi, Brian.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I can hear you.
I had no idea I was going to get into Julie and Simon. Hi, you guys.
What's up, man?
I've been.
Well, hey, Brian.
I heard a story about. I think it was your reservation, Simon, or prison camp, Rosebud, and a number of others in South Dakota have outlawed Christy Noem from setting foot on the res. I love.
Yeah, we banned her. Yeah, she's
tell
not
me,
allowed to
tell
come.
Tell me this.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened?
She was racist. She said some awful shit. She said some awful things about the Indigenous people south of the border. And so we're like, oh, okay, well, you seem to be a horrible human being. As separate sovereign nations, we're going to ban your ass from coming onto our reservation. Because remember, when you enter a res, you've technically left the United States. We have our own president. We have our own vice president. We have our own laws. We can persecute you. Or prosecute, not persecute you, but in this sense, she can persecute as well. Oh, yeah. No, that's seriously. She has said awful things about Indigenous people up and down.
She was trying to link the nations to cartel activity, wasn't she? Like, she wants to be Trump's vice president so bad that she'll try to be racist against Indians, even though that's not testing as well this year with American racists.
Yeah, she associated us with the cartels down in Mexico, and not unlike Trump when he was talking about the casinos in New York, and he was like, oh, the Italian, the mobs, they're going to work together, the mafia and the Native Americans with these casinos. And now Christy Noem is doing that with Indigenous people, saying that they're using reservations as a funnel for drugs.
Yeah, and just what she said, just what she said about the using razor wire to keep people out, you know, from crossing the border. That's another, you know, reason why Indigenous nations have said, you know what, you're not welcome here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's the governor and she's now banned from 17% of her own state.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. You got to get somebody. She sets foot, arrest her ass, put her in a cell for a night.
Well, she hasn't come. I mean, she hasn't tested it yet.
Yeah. And why would she? Like, why would she? What's she going to do? Go there to represent people? Go there to try to make things better? Go there to try to create understanding and seek forgiveness? She doesn't care.
No, not at all. I think she would go there just to say, you can't stop me from coming on here. That's her. I mean, that's how I would interpret
it. Oh, the flex.
Yeah, probably.
And hey, just another quick footnote on the AIM when I was a youngster, and I read the first, I'm blind, one of the first two or three, four or five books I listened to on tape was In the Spirit of Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And I learned a lot of the AIM characters. And I'm wondering, is Dino Butler still alive?
No, no. Unfortunately, a lot of our elders are with the American Indian Movement. Unfortunately, a lot of them have passed.
Yeah. As a young guy, I got a time off from the dairy and went up and, in my mind, I was just bearing witness to his trial. They had him on trial for murder. He killed some asshole in Lincoln City for grave robbing. And so anyways, he was acquitted. But I went and I had to go through metal detector to get into the courtroom, and they had a seat. And this is incredibly myopic, legally blind kid at 22 or 3 or whatever it was. And it was just fascinating. And apparently he had a pipe on the table the whole trial. And his dad, I heard later, said he just loved the judge because it was a fantastic judge. It was in Portland, Oregon. Anyways, it was
Leonard Peltier is still alive.
He's still with us.
Unfortunately, he's still in jail.
And he's still in jail and still can't get a new trial.
The evilness of that is just beyond the pale.
I know. Brian, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate hearing from you. We were at 866-997-4748. I wanted to ask you guys about this post that the White House tweeted out just 2 days ago. Roughly half of tribal households lack access to clean drinking water or adequate sanitation. Our administration is investing over $1 billion to accelerate the delivery of drinking water and community sanitation infrastructure projects in Indian country. I read this and part of me was like, wow, that's really inspiring. Part of me was like, what century is this that we're having this announcement made? Was this a welcome announcement or is this considered to be too little too late or something of both?
Julie? Well, I mean, it absolutely is welcomed. You know, there are thousands of communities across Turtle Island that don't have clean drinking water. And I know also we're talking about Flint, Michigan. I'm you know, right behind, you know, I think drinking water is important for everybody. But Indigenous nations are oftentimes, you know, pushed to the margins and they're not in, you know, they're purposely been put on these lands that, you know, they're desolate and there's not a lot there. And so to be able to have clean drinking water and sanitation infrastructure, it's so important for Indigenous communities. And it's, you know, it's not just a financial commitment because it's a significant amount. It's over $1 billion, I think, the Biden administration pledged for this. And it's so important. It's a crucial step towards equity and sustainability for so many people. So I think it's welcomed. Simon?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I hate about this is that people are like, oh, shit, Indians drinking water now. And it's on the news. I was waiting to see it on MSNBC or CNN. We're talking about it like, here's this. We're the smallest racial minority in the United States, but we don't get this news coverage. Like, nobody's saying anything about the fact that Indigenous people don't have access to drinking water on what we're originally founded as prison camps. And then that's not making it into the news. And it's only here that we're talking about it, but they haven't said diddly shit in mainstream news about the fact that Indigenous people still have to truck their water in. I mean, think about what we take for granted. The fact that you could turn on your faucet and you don't give a shit. You don't have to save anything. You save every drop of water. Doesn't matter if you're showering or if you're going to do dishes or you want to make some food. Indigenous people pay very close attention to every drop of water because you don't know when you're going to get it again.
Yeah.
Funny enough, you know, there's the comments section is always a place to avoid, but there's a lot of people. One of the comments was, my grandmother left the reservation to become a part of society. I suggest those on reservations do the same, and they too can just turn on the faucet like the rest of us, which is a pretty ignorant thing to say. I mean,
how many people in reservations are still part of the society? That's just where they live. God, I can't believe this. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Julie.
But I would compare it to if somebody said to you, well, you know, there's a Great Depression here in the United States. You know, why don't you just leave? Well, just leave the country. That's like saying that to somebody who lives on reservation, you know, like that's their home, that's their land. And to say, you know, well, just leave. Why don't you just leave? It's not that simple. It's not that easy. It is comparable to saying, why, you know, hey, there's a depression here in the U.S. Why don't you just leave? It's, well, you know, it's really comparable to that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to piggyback off that. You know, what really sucks is that it's either get off the reservation and get with society or go back to the reservation. That's right. What we face.
Yeah.
We face people literally saying, get off the reservation, get a job. And, you know, basically it's the kill the Indian, save the man mentality. It's like, come white and Christian or go back to the reservation. So either they're saying get off the res or go back to it.
Yeah. They're saying be like us or disappear.
Right.
Yeah. One more little comment that I read. Please. Somebody wrote on this White House announcement of, you know, giving Indians clean water. Nice. But will they appreciate it? They were given homes where I live. They tore them up. So I don't think they'll appreciate it.
Yeah, that comment section is really worth it. I mean, anybody just go to that, the White House Twitter page, see this tweet and just read. And then you'll understand how much anti-Indigenous nastiness is still out there.
Yeah.
My favorite, though, I have to say, please. My favorite is... Don't they do the rain dance to get their water? That was the other one I liked.
No.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No one said rain that. Dance. They said that, really?
Oh, they do it all the time too. Even like joking, like it doesn't matter in society. It happens. Say, hey, Simon's here. Hey, we need some rain. Why don't you do a dance? And ha 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 ha. Yeah, no, they do that all the time, man.
I don't know if I'm more appalled as a white person or as a comedian, but both sides of me are deeply appalled. Let's go to the phones. David in Santa Fe. Hello and welcome. Thanks for waiting patiently on hold all night. You're on with Simon Medley. Hello.
Hey. Hey, everybody. Good to talk to you.
What's up?
Hi, David.
Hi. Hey, Julie.
Hey. What's on your mind?
You've been covering a couple of things that I wanted to cover. So, you know,
tell us.
You know, well, about health and medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody talks about health care. Well, what do they mean? Medical care or health care? Because there are two things. But anyway, you covered a lot of that already.
Okay.
And the other thing was things like environmental poisons, contaminated water. These are the things that need to be talked about.
Yes.
And
100%.
As opposed to shit like sports teams names and fucking 1950s movies that somebody saw.
It all matters, I mean, though. The sports teams names matter, though. I mean,
that matters. But these other things like environmental poisons, medical care, contaminated water, and poverty, those are much more important, I think.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to go with you on that, David. But also, as I've told, I've mentioned this many, many times, that it has been empirically proven that mascots harm the mental health and stability of our kids. And so our kids, unfortunately, are more likely to commit suicide, meaning Indigenous children, than other children of other demographics. So I don't want to push mascots off. And I understand clean water is extremely important. That's why we were fighting up at Standing Rock for all that time that we were there. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge the science that shows us that there is a detrimental impact of these Indian names and mascots on our kids.
Agree with you on that. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out.
Right on.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
thank you. Oh, go ahead, please.
In the last few years, I've heard many times, and it makes me want to spit, is people say, oh, this American experiment. It's not a fucking experiment, people. they tried a lot of experiments. You know, like, Trail of Tears, you know? All the things on and on, shit. But it's not an experiment. That's a cop-out, I think, because people think, oh, well, it's an experiment. You know, we fucked up. Oh, we did this.
I see.
That was pretty bad, but it was just...
Right, it takes away the agency. It takes away the agency and the culpability by just saying, oh, we were trying something out. I get you.
Right.
Yeah,
thank you,
well,
man.
I've
I appreciate
never
the
heard
call.
You say that, John, but I've heard so many commentators everywhere say, oh, it's an experiment and it's not.
Well, a lot of our elders.
It's a trope. I've probably said it before.
Well, a lot of our elders still call the United States a colony. It's like, it's really, they're like, we never fucking gave it to you. You right guys on. Like gave your own, you guys gave it a name. You basically nationalized yourself. It's like, but you came on stolen land, gave something a name, said that you did it legally, whatever the fuck that means. Like land theft and rape and murder and genocide is the right way to do it. Bullshit. So a lot of our elders still call the United States a very old colony.
Right on. We have to take a break. David, I thank you for the call. Simon and Julie, I have a lot more I want to talk to you guys about. Will you please stay with us through the break?
Let's do it.
Sure.
Be right back in just a second. We're at 866-997-4748. This is Progress. Don't go away.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back with Julie Francella and Simon Moya-Smith at 866-997-GRIT. I want to get to some more calls, but I want to ask you, Julie, we've talked a lot about the epidemic, both in the U.S. and Canada, of abductions of Indigenous women. And not just the epidemic of the abductions, but the epidemic of media indifference to these abductions. We've talked a lot about the missing white blonde syndrome. Can you explain for our listeners and for people who aren't familiar with the Canadian government, what is the red dress alert system?
Yes, this is something that we're hoping that the United States will follow suit with. And basically, the Canadian government has been taking, in response basically to the longstanding issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and two-spirited people, steps towards addressing this. So in 2021, in their budget, they actually earmarked $2.2 billion over 5 years to specifically for something they call the Red Dress Alert System. So basically, it's a national system into where they have a alert system where they actually, if an Indigenous person goes missing, there's a lot of media attention on it. So that's something that we don't see. So they're putting money behind it, which you don't often see. So, you know, now fast forward to 2024, 2023, and there's actually further developments and this is where they're actually launching this red dress alert system. And it's a tool designed to quickly inform the public whenever an Indigenous woman, girl, or two-spirit person, and now they're actually expanding that to males as well, because boys and men are going missing as well. And so the initiative, it's crucial part of the federal government's national action plan to tackle missing and murdered Indigenous people. And we're hoping that the U.S. government will do this in addition to Canada.
It's like an Amber Alert for people that aren't familiar.
It's an Amber Alert. Talked about this before. The homicide rate against Indigenous women and girls is like six times higher than non-Indigenous women and girls. Mm-hmm. And yet we're just trying to get a program in place, an alert system. I mean, I'm grateful it's happening, but how much suffering went down before this announcement?
But it tells you, I mean, we're in a situation where this is needed and people are like, holy shit, what's happening to Indigenous women? What's happening to Two-Spirits? Remember, Two-Spirit doesn't exactly mean gay. Two-Spirit for Indigenous people, that is a role that is also, it's very spiritual, very holy, but it's the way we reference LGBTQ. But again, unfortunately, this isn't very well known. You know, murdered and missing Indigenous peoples isn't well known. There is the state of California just recently recognized Indigenous people, and they illuminated, meaning murdered and missing Indigenous peoples, and they illuminated their capital in red to alert people and show, hey, Indigenous women, Indigenous LGBTQ and boys are going missing. But why, right? And nobody's asking the why part. Well, the why part is tied to oil and gas. You have to remember that around reservations is this open land, and you're going to find oil and gas infrastructures, and they bring men in and they build what are called man camps. Whenever they build these man camps around the reservation, the number of Indigenous women, LGBTQ, and boys, that skyrockets. And so people are like, why is it just Indians? What's going on? Are they going into certain areas and just targeting them? No, they're around the reservation working on oil and gas, and then they're fucking horny. They're horny and they're surrounded by themselves and they're alone. So oil and gas has a big, big thing to do with murdered and missing Indigenous people.
And yet, try to imagine the oil and gas industry having any kind of reckoning on this sort of issue. Try
they
to
don't
imagine
say anything
public
about
pressure
either, yeah.
being great enough to make these CEOs lift a finger to monitor their own employees.
No, right. They don't. They don't say a thing.
The other thing, too, I think that it's important for your listeners to understand is that nobody's going to notice or nobody's going to complain if an Indigenous woman goes missing or an Indigenous person goes missing. Like you've seen, you know, no offense, but, you know, a blonde white woman going missing and there's media attention everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Indigenous women go missing and nobody says anything. Do you think that people who... you know, predators out there, they're pretty smart and they will figure that out. And
they know.
if we take an Indigenous woman, nobody's going to care. So that's oftentimes why they are targeted.
And remember, this isn't an epidemic. This is a pandemic. This is something that happens in Canada, in Alaska, here in the lower 48, and in Mexico. In Mexico, they're called maquiladoras. And that's where a lot of the American corporations, you know, avoiding taxes, will build their little take whatever facility from here, just over the border. And then the women work there and then they go missing. There's actually a story in the New York Times where a grandma is seen walking down there on the border with a shovel just so she can find all of the female bodies that are buried in shallow graves.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to calls, but I want to believe that this can become like a hot issue young people start caring about and making TikTok videos about. It just sort of seems like I've given up hope of the establishments doing it and the media doing it and the institutions doing it. But maybe this could be a thing that young people could be the generation to give a fuck and actually make an effort. And I hate to say this phrase, but popularize the issue, because I have to believe that the majority of people would care if they knew this pandemic was going on. Julie, is that a little too Pollyanna-ish?
No, I think that actually is happening. There are a lot of, like you said, TikTok accounts, Indigenous influencers out there that are talking about, you know, missing and murdered Indigenous women. One of them being Lily Gladstone. That is a issue that is near and dear to her heart. She brings it up often. She talks about it a lot on her social media. She was given an award for being a voice. I think it was Leonardo DiCaprio that presented the award to her. So in that sense, you know, there is some media attention. It's getting out there. And, you know, you see the images with the red handprint across the face. That's what it represents, missing and murdered Indigenous people. So take a look on social media and you'll see. Just do an MMIP or an MMIW search and there'll be tons of information out there.
Well, the problem also is in media is that it's so the most male, most white industry isn't oil and gas, isn't banking, it's media. And if you look up the documentary Misrepresentation, M-I-S-S, and it demonstrates how white males are the gatekeepers of the stories that you listen to, that you watch. And so it's about trying to get those stories out there. Even today, even with the White House tweeting about giving Indigenous people drinking water, didn't fucking make it. I mean, seriously, something as simple as drinking water in indigenous people wasn't important enough for these people. So it's about getting past those gatekeepers. And they're usually old white men that we're trying to convince to just please let us tell these stories.
But it's also profit-driven news. That's it. I mean, it's profit-driven, ratings-driven, popularity-driven news. So on a day when Donald Trump is shitting on the rule of law in the Supreme Court while he's also on trial for the porn star in New York City court, media's not going to talk about other things that matter because journalists have a responsibility to inform. Media has a responsibility to get ratings and turn profit. I'd like to think that missing people are enough to get the attention of viewers and turn a profit for these media companies, but we'll never know because they don't cover it unless it's a Natalie Holloway, God bless her. But that's the only time
I also tell my students. I tell my students, you know, it's like we have to remember that journalism is a business.
That's it.
And so they're going to focus on like what sells. Think of any business. It could be a fucking donut shop. It's like they're going to put their best sellers up front. And so even though we do have the responsibility to tell these stories, they are still a corporation. And so that's why they don't tell the narrative. And as an editor once told me when I was writing at NBC News at 30 Rock, they said, well, the only reason we don't have an NBC Native America is because it won't generate money. There's an NBC Asian, there's an NBC Latino, there's an NBC Women, there's an NBC Black, but there's no NBC Native vertical because they don't think they'll make money off of us.
There you go. That's media. That's not journalism. That's corporate media.
Right.
Let's go to the phones. Terry is on the line from New Mexico. Terry, thank you so much for waiting on hold. You're on with Simon and Julie. Welcome.
Hello. I wanted to say thank you for covering this topic. I'm in the Four Corners in New Mexico. I live on a border town. Originally, I was raised on the reservation, but now I live on the border town, actually, still.
Nice.
Anyway, a lot of nails are hit on the head tonight with this topic, and I wanted to talk about, the first thing was the economic terrorism that goes on.
Okay.
With Native people. You covered terrorism yesterday, and I was laughing when I heard that guy misrepresent a Muslim man.
Oh, yeah. We had a great racist last night. One of our racists who calls up every now and then, and he was talking about how he hates Muslims, and it was beautiful. He was saying how he has a neighbor who's Muslim, and he's never talked to his neighbor. And I was like, well, has your neighbor ever been mean to you, or why won't you talk to him? I don't know. I've never even talked to him. And then Chris, who's smarter than me, asked this troll, how do you know he's Muslim? And the guy said, well, he has a turban and a beard. And I was like, you idiot. That's a Sikh.
Yeah.
You can't even fucking hate right.
Oh yeah. Wow. We live with that kind of racism every day on border towns.
Amen.
Oh, yeah. And it's ridiculous. And, you know, I go to IHS. Well, one of the things I wanted to bring up was the anti-native bias. I call myself native. I never say American. I'm native, I say.
Right on.
But one thing that a lot of employers in border towns tend to like to hire native people because they get out of covering healthcare for us. We don't have to provide healthcare or dental or any of that. You know, a lot of that attitude is prevalent with a lot of employers on border towns. And I was blatantly told that by my boss. Another thing that I wanted to bring up was, I work for a parcel company, a large major logistic company in the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every day I deliver to these privileged ass people. And every day, I just see the grotesque colonization of what was once indigenous land. And it kind of pisses me off, but I continue to work. But what's awful about that is the mascot issue comes up because I delivered to Durango, Colorado, and there's this awful mascot in the middle of town of a Native American figure. And many, many students have a long time tried to get it removed, but even the town of Durango sanctioned it and call it, well, it's a tourist attraction, so it's a good thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right. The Wild West.
Ridiculous. Yeah, every day I drive by that thing and I despise looking at it because it depicts me.
Right.
And I don't look like that. You know, I'm a hardworking blue-collar guy. You know, I work 10-hour days for these people. And you know, that's the other thing. One other topic I wanted to bring up too was this, what is all talked about tonight? And what was all covered was it's terrorism in itself. Mm. That's the way I view it. It's the colonizers terrorizing indigenous people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Undermining the economic well-being.
Yeah. It's in the fabric of the United States. That's how this country was founded. That's how it was developed. Right. And it's continuing today.
Yeah.
Right now in the media in Israel, indigenous people are totally being destroyed by colonizers.
Yeah.
By people that aren't indigenous there. That's the way I see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
we've talked about that.
We're destroying them with colonizers' weapons, you know, which is coming from here. Right. And it pisses me off because it's never, the true story about the indigenous struggle was never covered, and it's never covered in the media. And that was prevalent, and that was true. That was true during the Standing Rock protests.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because we were protesting the terrorism that these oil companies were doing to our land, to our drinking water.
Were you up there at Standing Rock too?
I wasn't up there. I really wanted to quit my job and go. I was really, really tempted just to like walk off my job and go there. But there was a lot of people from our community that went there, from our tribe that went there. And
we're going to have to talk about that at some point. I mean, I think we mentioned Standing Rock often enough without going into it, but I was up there. I lived up there. I lived in the Oglala camp, et cetera. So, but one of these days, we're going to have to talk about it.
I'd love to talk about it. And Terry, I'm so sorry we're hitting a break. I've got to go to commercial, but thank you for your call. I love your call, and I hope you'll call us more often. It's really a pleasure to hear your story.
Thank you.
Let's take a really quick call for Simon and Julie. Really quick, just for Frank in Georgia, because it's a special day. You're on with Simon and Julie. Frank, hello.
Hey, John and Julie and Simon.
Hi, Frank.
The show I was talking about is Murder in Bighorn. Have y'all seen that?
What's it called?
Yeah, your phone.
Murder in Bighorn.
Oh, Murder in Bighorn. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have y'all seen that?
Yeah, that's a documentary.
That breaks my heart. I mean, I watched the first episode, and it's like, I mean, I just could not watch it anymore. It was so horrifying that that's happening, you know, real life. And there's nothing they can do about it. And I watched it some more, but, I mean, it's just very, very difficult because I just feel so terrible. And, I mean, the way the infrastructure is made, it just begs it to happen. And they have no recourse.
No, and they justified it with a Bible. That's a lot of it they literally said, well, no, Jesus said we can do this, and I'm Christian and you're not.
And speaking of that, 1923, y'all were talking about that last week, and that's
a show.
Horrific.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Is, I mean,
we have the actor who plays the priest on our show a couple times. I mean, that's an amazing, amazing show and horrifying.
He's a good guy.
Great job.
Yeah.
But,
Frank, is this your birthday? Is today your birthday, sir?
No, man, I called a couple of weeks ago and it was my birthday. I mentioned that I called a couple of weeks ago on April 11th. Remember when all those great birthdays happened?
It's not your birthday, but happy birthday anyway. You're still in April. It still counts.
It's your birthday month.
Happy birthday, man. Happy birthday. Listen, if you get a chance, try to watch the film Incident at Oglala, produced by Robert Redford, that tells the story of Leonard Peltier and why he's in jail. It's not a series. It's just a documentary, and it is completely gripping. It's really worth watching.
Right on.
Thank you, man.
Also, Indian Horse.
And Indian Horse, too. We're out of time, and we didn't even have a chance to do any Did You Knows. I'm so sorry, guys.
Damn.
There was so much to talk about and so many callers. Simon, how do our listeners follow you and keep up with all your work?
On Instagram at Simon Said Take a Pic, or on Twitter or X at Simon Moya Smith.
Julie?
You can follow me at Julie Francella on all social media.
Guys, I love this segment. I look forward to it every week. Thank you so much for elevating the whole discourse. We're honored to have you both. It's just precious to us. Have a great evening and a great week.
Thank you so much.